Welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast, where our job is to help you build visibility, professional credibility, and connection with your ideal client by putting the human at the center of innovative marketing, so you can build and strengthen an engaging, enduring relationship with your ideal clients. I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and I'm honored that you're here with me. If you haven't joined our wonderful marketing transformation community yet, go to innovabiz.co and collect your free gift as well. Do subscribe to the show and also leave a review because it helps others find us. Let's get into today's masterclass on this InnovaBuzz podcast.
Flipping the eye has two meanings. One is looking internally at yourself, your own belief systems, why you believe, who you are, and how you are as a leader. But it also has to do with flipping the eye. Can we look at the world through the lens of other people who are different from us? With empathy and with compassion, it's not about us as leaders. It's about other people and making my personal mission is making the world a better place, one leader at a time. And to me, everyone is a leader in one way or another. So if you start with that foundation, flipping the eye is about how can I, it's not about me anymore. It's about how can I help you make your vision a reality? And that to me is what true leadership is all about.
Welcome back. I hope you've had an awesome week so far. If you haven't yet listened to my recent conversations with personal branding expert Tamara Glick, and with Simon Severino of Strategy Sprints, then go check them out, but only after you've listened to today's conversation, of course. I'm really excited today to have on the InnovaBuzz podcast as my guest, Todd Churches. Todd's the CEO and co-founder of Big Blue Gumball, a consulting firm specializing in leadership development, public speaking, and executive coaching. Todd is also a three-time award-winning adjunct professor of leadership in the Human Capital Management Master's Program at New York University and a lecturer on leadership at Columbia University, as well as a TEDx speaker and the author of Visual Leadership, Leveraging the Power of Visual Thinking in Leadership and in Life. In our discussion today, Todd talked to me about why visual thinking and visual language is so important in communication and in making ourselves understood. He described the components of a good story, and we talked about what we can learn from Pictionary. Without further ado, then, let's fly into the hive and get the buzz from Todd Churches. Hi, I'm your host, Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and I'm really excited to welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast today from New York in the USA, Todd Churches, who's the CEO of executive coaching firm Big Blue Gumball, as well as an award-winning adjunct professor of leadership at New York University and Columbia. He's a TEDx speaker and also the author of Visual Leadership, Leveraging the Power of Visual Thinking in Leadership and in Life. Welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast, Todd. It's a real privilege to have you as my guest.
Thank you, Jürgen. I crossed the spanning the oceans, right, from New York to Australia. We're spanning the globe.
That's right. And our listeners actually reach even further west than that through Manila, through Philippines, through India, I know, and all the way back into Europe and then into the east coast of the US again. So we've done a Columbus circumnavigation.
That's great. I'm sure they're listening to you on the International Space Station as well. So I'm sure your innovation messages are reaching far and wide to other planets and solar systems.
Yeah. So hello to them. And also hello to Maxine Cunningham, who runs Pick My Brain, and she connected us through her platform. That's where we first met. And she was our guest on episode 306 of the InnovaBuzz podcast. So big shout out to Maxine. I know she listens.
Okay, great, great. Yeah, you were the very first person I met through Maxine. So we were just thrown together in a 5-minute breakout session, and look where we ended up.
Yeah, right. All right. Now, you help leaders to see, as you put it, which is very appropriate, given that the book's all about visual leadership, and to communicate more clearly, as well as enable them to envision a future that they never even dreamed possible. So that's kind of, I think that's the cover or inside the cover of the book. And I thought, well, that's brilliant. There's a lot of visual language there, you know, clear and envision and dream and seeing and so on. So I'm really keen to dig into that a lot further. Tell us a little bit. I know there's a great story in the book. Tell us a little bit about how you discovered the power of visual communication and translated that into visual leadership.
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, it's almost hard to figure out. We're all visual thinkers. We're all visual people. It's just the way the brain is wired. Some people say I'm more auditory or I'm more kinesthetic. And, you know, they have the different learning styles. They're not really learning styles. They're different modalities of taking in information through our eyes, through our ears, through our touch, through movement, right? But research and science has shown that we're all wired to take in information visually. So that goes back to like a baby making eye contact with their parents for the first time. That goes back to cave people being out in the jungle or wherever they were and seeing a tiger in you know, hiding in the brush, you know, whatever it is. So it's like we're all wired to take in information through our senses. And research has shown that when we're reading, you know, a lot of business people are always thinking about the text and the numbers and everything, but it's really about what's the message, right? It's about communication. And ultimately, it's about changing the world through our ideas. So one of my mantras is, how do you get other people to see, quote unquote, see what you're saying? How do you get an idea from your head and into someone else's so that they could say, yes, I get it, right? That's what we're all trying to do. So if you're trying to innovate and come up with new ideas, you can have the greatest idea in the world, but if you can't get other people to see it, it's just going to die on, you know, there on the table, right? So it's like, how do you influence? How do you impact people? How do you change the world? And a big part of visual thinking is, and visual leadership, is thinking about the lens through which you see the world influences how you lead and who you are as a leader, right? And when we, in my NYU and Columbia leadership classes, when we ask people, what's the first word that comes to mind when you hear the word leadership, the word vision comes up, if not first, then definitely second or third, right? And so what does it mean to have a leadership vision? What does it mean when we call someone like an Elon Musk or Branson or Steve Jobs a visionary leader, right? They saw the world through fresh eyes. They saw possibilities, whether it's ideas, products, services that other people may never have dreamed possible, right? That's what is at the foundation of what visual leadership is all about.
Yeah. And we talk a lot about painting a picture. Let me paint a picture for you about what the future could look like. And don't we, even regardless of what kind of our preferred modality of communication might be, there's always that once we start talking vision and what are some goals we have, there's a lot of visual language that's actually used. And I think that kind of speaks to us having a picture in our mind, actually, of what we're trying to communicate. And I know I was out riding last weekend, and I've got this thing about canola fields. You know, the bright yellow of the canola is kind of really striking, and particularly if it's in the sunshine, it's got some nice scenery in the background. And I always take lots of photos, and I've probably got about 15, 20, 30 years a collection of canola field photos every season. And one of the things for me, I mean, there's actually a smell to the canola field freshly blooms, and that smell is a trigger for me because it reminds me of when I was in graduate school in chemistry. One of the products I was working on was actually an essential oil from canola, and so that transports me back into that time. But the visual part of that is also a very strong trigger, and so there's lots of triggers we have that are visual, right? We see a picture, we see a scene in front of us, and it just triggers a memory or triggers a story.
Yeah, what you just said triggered so many things in my head, I don't even know where to start. But one of them is the fact that, yeah, when we're talking about visuals, a lot of times we're thinking about pictures, and it's not just PowerPoint slides, it's not just drawing, it's visual imagery that can be taken in through our ears, right? So if you're telling me a story, I'm hearing it through my ears, but I'm visualizing it in my mind's eye, right? So, and Shakespeare coined the term or popularized the term to see something in your mind's eye. When he saw the ghost of his father, he didn't know if it was an actual ghost or a figment of his imagination. And he says to Horatio, I think I see my father. And Horatio says, where? And Hamlet says, in my mind's eye, right? So we see something in our mind's eye, and sometimes we can't even separate our visions from our realities, right? So a big part of leadership is making those visions realities. Another thing that you really just reminded me of, and I was even though I work in the business world and a lot of, because I teach management leadership, people assume I have a business background, but my background is in English literature with a concentration in Shakespeare and poetry. So as you were talking, I was thinking of, I don't know if you're familiar with William Wordsworth's poem, The Daffodils, but Wordsworth coined the phrase emotion recollected in tranquility. So when you could be in the poem, The Daffodils, without reciting the whole poem, but basically says, when I'm sitting on my couch, I get the image of the daffodils in my mind, and my heart with pleasure fills and dances with the daffodils. So that's a metaphor. A heart literally cannot dance, right? But it's the feeling, that emotion, that joy that makes you feel like you're dancing in your heart just from thinking and picturing what it was like. So it also reminds me of Marcel Proust and that Madeleine, you know, that taste of that, you know. So just like you said, you smell those flowers and it takes you back to another time and place. That's just another way of using our senses to visualize and to experience life. So all of those things came flooding back to me just from your canola story.
Yeah. Well, one of the things, and certainly I know you're a big fan of Shakespeare, and one of the things he certainly did really well and always struck me is he was able to tell a story in the written word in a way that you could actually imagine it. And I remember seeing a friend of mine when I was in Germany, when I lived in Germany, a friend of mine used to have a get together of all his friends for an annual festival at this, like it was like a natural rock formation in the forest. And they'd set up this stage there and they used to do plays. And they did a lot of the German classics like Goethe and Schiller and those things. But I remember one year they did Hamlet on stage, and I thought, this is exactly like I pictured Hamlet when I studied it at school, because, you know, and it sort of, it was almost as if, yeah, that's exactly how it was in my mind, you know, just the visual scenery.
Yeah, when those plays were first performed on the Globe Theater, Globe Stage, there was minimal sets or set decoration, right? It was during the daylight. There was no lighting effects. There was no, right? So Shakespeare had to create this world through the language. Like in Twelfth Night, when, you know, one of the lines is, what country, friends, is this, or what country, sir, is this? It's Illyria, lady. So it's like he had to basically put people in a time and place through the word, through the language, and people had to suspend disbelief and believe what they were watching. So so that's a great example of creating a reality, a visual reality, completely through language.
So how can we do that in our communication, painting that, creating that sort of effect that people walk away and say, yep, I've got a picture in my mind, or I've got a movie in my mind of exactly what you're describing? And not only that, it actually is pretty much what was intended.
Yeah, well, I break it down into four categories in my book, and just to sum it up. So there's a lot of different ways to communicate visually, through the physical eye or even through your ear, as I was just describing. So one is through using visual imagery and drawing, right? So if I say, Jürgen, look at this, and I show you a picture, you're going to be focused on it, right? You're going to be looking at what I'm looking at. It could be a PowerPoint slide, it could be a picture from a magazine. You know, it could be a physical object. I'm showing you something. I could sketch something out on a whiteboard or on a flip chart or on a napkin sketch, right? So that's something, that's information taken in through the physical eye. So that's using visual images and drawing. Category two is using mental models and frameworks. So if I drew you an organizational chart of a company, if I gave you a map of the city of New York and the subway system, if I showed you Maslow's hierarchy of needs or Stephen Covey's, from his book, The Seven Habits, the four quadrants, the time management matrix, right? Those are all models or frameworks through which you can take the messiness and complexity of life and put them in some kind of diagram or visual framework so that you could see it more clearly. So we always talk about thinking outside the box, but one of my phrases is we need to think inside the box first. So we need to take the complexity and messiness of life, find some kind of framework or box to put things in so we could see it more clearly, And once we do, we start to see solutions that we couldn't see beforehand, right? So we always say, think outside the box. And innovation, that's one of those catchphrases, right? Or even a cliche now. We need to think outside the box. But what's the box, right? So if you put something into four quadrants or a five-level pyramid, then it's like, okay, now I'm seeing things. Now there's a way of mentally processing this complexity to simplify it to find solutions. So that's category two, mental models and framework. Category three is using metaphor and analogy. And we talked about a few of those before. Robert Burns, the poet, said, my love is like a red, red rose that's newly sprung in June, right? So you say, how is new love like a fresh new rose, right? So we use metaphor all the time to say this is kind of like that for the purpose of explaining things. But our metaphors and analogies need to be relevant to our audience. So I'm a big baseball fan and a Yankees fan, right? But if I'm telling you a story using a baseball analogy or a baseball story down in Australia, that may not resonate. While a rugby analogy, a soccer/football analogy, tennis is more universal, right? So the metaphors and analogies we use need to be relevant to your audience, because otherwise, instead of simplifying complexity, you actually do the opposite and create more complexity, right? If I was going to use a baseball analogy with someone who doesn't know anything about baseball. And the last category is storytelling, and extra points if you can incorporate humor, because people think in stories. Stories are human, they are emotional, they are memorable, and storytelling is just makes us human. If you think about it, you know, grandparents tell their grandchildren stories, children tell their friends stories. Like, storytelling is just innate in who we are. If I say, how was your day today? And you say, you wouldn't believe what happened to me. You're starting to tell me a story, right? Stories have a beginning, middle, and end. Aristotle said that thousands of years ago. Stories have villains, victims, and heroes. Stories have highs and lows, right? So when you take someone on a journey through your story, you're getting that idea out of your head and into theirs so they can actually visualize it. So I'll stop there, but those are my four categories. That's how I kind of break it up. And again, some people prefer one type. Some people say, I love picking up a pen and drawing. Other people say, I can't do that, but I could tell a good story, or I'm good at using metaphors and analogies. So that's what I'd say is these are all learnable skills, which is great.
Yeah, and I remember you telling me about this in probably even less words than that when we first met, and I thought, you've sold me. I'm going to go buy your book as soon as we're done here. And I did. And it's brilliant. It's a really neat framework to tackle all the skills. And I guess to me, in some ways, they're also interconnected and interwoven. Mm-hmm. Because if you think of, one of my mentors in podcasting talks about being really interesting in just an audio framework where somebody is only listening to your voice. And he talks about the theater of the mind, which essentially is telling a story in a way that actually paints a picture for the listener. And he also talks a lot about what you've just said, you know, taking them on a journey and, you know, going through the highs and lows and whatever's involved in that story, but actually taking your listener along with you on that journey.
Yeah. And that's a metaphor, right? The theater of the mind, right? As soon as you said that phrase, all these things, I'm picturing a curtain, I'm picturing characters, right? So what does that mean? It's like your mind's eye is a metaphor, theater of the mind. Shakespeare said that all the world's a stage and all the men and women merely players, right? We have our exits and our entrances, and each man in his time plays many roles, right? So I'm paraphrasing, but basically, again, that's an example. Like, if you think of all the world as being a stage, right? Are you performing? Are you playing a role? Or are you being authentic, right? So those are all, that's just a great way to frame who we are and how we show up in the world, right? With other people.
So how can we, metaphors is one thing that I'm really fascinated by, particularly because there's lots of metaphors. So theater of the mind is a really great example of somebody that came up with an original one. And I know you've got some examples of original ones that you use, but you alluded to, you know, sports analogies, and there's heaps of sports ones. I mean, cricket was one you didn't mention, and you're probably not familiar with cricket. Yeah. But
No, I actually have. I just did a presentation today where I said, instead of baseball, I gave four different types. If you could use soccer or football, hockey, rugby, and cricket, then you're covering, and I use both male and female athletes of different diverse cultural backgrounds. So a lot of times we think only in, like, I see everything through the lens of baseball and the Yankees and the Mets, right? Because I'm a New York baseball fan. But as you're saying, you need to broaden into other sports, and we need to think in terms of the world of diversity, inclusion, and belonging. We need to be more all-encompassing. And so that's, thank you for that reminder that, yes, rugby, cricket, those are all sports that we can leverage. But not just sports, because not everyone's into sports, right? So
that's right. Well, what I was thinking, how do you develop kind of your own unique metaphors that you can use rather than defaulting to ones that perhaps are a little cliched? Like a lot of the sporting ones to me are a little cliched. I mean, there's one classic example from cricket. I don't know if this is meaningful to you. And I don't know if the baseball equivalent of this, but it's let that one go through to the keeper. And essentially, in cricket, you don't have to hit every ball that's bowled at you. Mm-hmm. If it's not, you know, if it's not endangering the stumps, which if they're hit, you're dismissed, right? You're out. If it's not endangering them, then you don't actually have to hit it, and you don't have to take a risk of hitting a ball that might not be in your sweet spot, because that could lead to your dismissal as well. So leaving it go through to the keeper is a metaphor for, you know, that particular, let's say somebody said something to you, that particular comment can't hurt you, so you might as well just ignore it and not respond. That's the metaphor, but that is a really common and almost overused metaphor.
I never heard that one before, but I know just enough about cricket to get the gist of it. And then when you, with your explanation, it became clear. So the baseball equivalent of that would be take a pitch, meaning let the pitch go by. But in cricket, isn't the pitch the field, right? So
it's actually the playing surface, where they bowl the ball, the middle part.
Right. So in baseball, if you say a pitch, you talk about the pitcher throwing the ball. So if I say take a pitch, that means don't swing at it, let it go by. But you might be thinking, the pitch is the field. What do you mean take it? Where am I taking it? I'm not taking the field anywhere, right? So even they say we're divided by a common language, and that's a great example of that.
Hmm. So coming back to the metaphor, though, in terms of, there's a lot of these ones that I think are a bit overused perhaps, and people default to them because they're everybody's familiar with them perhaps, and that might be a good thing on the one hand. But how do you come up with a unique metaphor that's kind of uniquely your own? Like, my mentor came up with the theater of the mind, and it's kind of your signature, so, and it's consistent with your character, your personality.
You need to kind of, like, for example, just for one example, like nature is universal, right? So if I say I'm going to plant the seed for an idea, we need to go out on a limb and see if it works and see if it bears fruit. Like right there, I'm using nature and right? Anyone can relate to that, regardless of where you grew up, what kind of trees you have, right? But there are also certain metaphors that come out of your industry or come out of your upbringing. And there's expressions that we may use in New York that you might say, wait, what? I have no idea what you're even talking about. Even my company's name is Big Blue Gumball. So what does Big Blue Gumball mean? It's a metaphor saying the world is like a big blue gumball, right? So, but if you don't know what a gumball is, do you know what a gumball is? Do they have gumballs down in Australia?
I think, I'm not sure. Yeah, they have similar things. I think I know what it is. It's like you take them out of the slot machine and they're sort of hard balls, but they end up being chewing gum or something like that.
That's exactly right. But I had someone recently who said, I said Big Blue Gumball represents, it's a metaphor that represents the world, the earth, the globe. The world is like a big blue gumball. It's hard and crunchy and blue and colorful on the outside, but we have to crack the exterior. And once you get to the interior, it's soft and chewy and more fun, right? So I just used that. And she said to me, wait, but what is a gumball? Like she literally had never heard that term before. So that's the thing. It's like, if you know what a gumball is, like you just described it, then you say, okay, I get it. You get it in 2 seconds of the explanation. But if you still don't know what a gumball is, then it doesn't mean anything. So I think that's the key thing. You always need to think about whenever we're communicating with anything, but specifically with metaphors and analogies, what do people know, right? What does my audience know? Because, again, not everything translates, right? So you need, if I say that's just the tip of the iceberg, that's a classic metaphor, right? So in my NYU class, I teach in the HR master's program, we said, how can HR people use an iceberg as a metaphor? When you're interviewing someone for a job, when you first meet them, it's just the tip of the iceberg, right? We know just the basic things about them. Our job is to dive beneath the surface to learn more, right? First, if someone's an overnight success, we only see you know, the success. We don't see the 30 years of pain and suffering and struggle that they went through, right? So the iceberg, the basic thing is, what does it represent? It represents what we see versus what's hidden from us, right? So right there, we use the iceberg, and someone else brought up Titanic, right?
Yeah. Right? Shuffling the deck chairs. I just thought about shuffling the deck chairs on the Titanic.
Exactly.
And that's probably a pretty universal one, because most of the world would know the story of the Titanic.
Yeah. But even an expression like that, shuffling the deck chairs on the Titanic, the first person who ever said that, people must have said, wow, that's a really cool original metaphor.
Yep.
Now it's become a cliche, right? So every metaphor or expression that you think of, someone at some point had to have been the first to say it, right? But at some point, over time, it gets to be a cliche, and then it loses its impact. So that's another thing. If you overuse cliches and or metaphors that are too familiar, then they lose their impact, because there's millions of them out there, and it's so if you come up with one that's more new, original, and fresh, you capture people's attention, and it has greater impact. Otherwise, it just, you know, it's like, oh, we've heard that one a million times before.
All right. And storytelling and humor. I mean, one of the things that fascinates me, and I try to kind of incorporate this into one of my podcasts, is telling a story in a way that's really interesting, bringing sort of natural humor in there. I don't force humor in there, but kind of the humor is, you know, a little bit self-deprecating, particularly if I'm relating a mistake I've made, or if I relate something that's happened to me that I wasn't expecting. But also using the story itself as a metaphor for the lesson I'm trying to impart. So how do we go about constructing something like that? Because that's something I'm really keen on being better at.
Yeah, I mean, some people say, I was once doing a workshop on the art of storytelling for a group of 20 CEOs. And one of the CEOs said, I'm here, but I hate storytelling. I'm a terrible storyteller. And then one of the other participants said, oh, you know, Bob, why do you say that? And this guy went on to tell this great story about why he's so bad at storytelling, right? So it turned out, and everyone looked at each other like, Bob, that was a great story. Why do you think you're not? So he didn't feel comfortable doing it. You know why? He was confusing storytelling with like joke telling or performance art. So if you say, how was work today? And you say, you wouldn't believe what happened to me. And I tell you this story. We share stories all the time. It's just who we are and how we communicate with people. So I think when we elevate storytelling to this unattainable, unachievable thing, like put on the mountaintop and say, I can't be that amazing a storyteller, then I think we kind of do ourselves a disservice. But if we just realize that storytelling is just sharing an experience or an episode of what happened, and regarding humor, I want to just point out, and this is important to emphasize, we're not talking about telling jokes. Some people are like, oh, I need some humor in here. So two people walked into a bar and it had nothing to do with your story, your message, or anything. They just thought, oh, I'll make people laugh and get them on my... That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about finding the humor in humanity. The humor has to be an anecdote or a story that's relevant to the message, right? So for example, in my book, I tell the story about one time I was sitting at my desk. I was working for a TV network out in Los Angeles. I won't mention which one, but it had a C, a B, and an S in its name. So I'm sitting at my desk, and my boss's office door flings open. I feel something whip by my head, and she had thrown a box of pens at me because she wanted the medium point, and these were the fine point. So she, instead of just saying to me, Todd, these are the wrong pens, she lost her mind. She threw it at me and started screaming at me, like, if you can't even order the right pens, you better get yourself another job. It's like she already had two other boxes in her office. So it was hardly an emergency situation. And yet, so now telling that story, it always gets a laugh and a smile. And my students are always like, oh my God, I can't believe that happened to you. And it's funny in retrospect. That was not funny on that day that it happened.
Right.
You could just imagine. Yeah. It was funny when I told people when I got home from work that day, you wouldn't believe what my psycho boss did today. And I actually kept an abuse log because this was just another day at the office with her. But you know, the humor of that is I incorporate that into when I'm teaching feedback in my class. I said, you know, how might you give someone feedback who didn't do what you asked them to do or didn't perform, you know, right? But that story, no one ever forgets it.
Yeah, I can imagine often there's times like that where it doesn't seem funny at the time, but then with hindsight or with distance or putting it into some other context, then it becomes a humorous story, at least from the point of view of the people, get a bit of a laugh out of it.
Yeah, I once heard the expression that comedy is tragedy plus time. So it's like you need to, something, yeah. Things that are not funny in the moment, you find the humor it, you know, later on down the road.
Yeah. Well, I've got one like that where I had a fairly serious bike accident off my road bike. When was this? About 5 years ago now. And I remember, and I went over the handlebars at speed. I broke 4 ribs in the back. I smashed my collarbone into 5 pieces. And I banged my head on the road. Although at the time I didn't realize that I'd banged my head. I actually felt I was completely cognizant in that. In fact, I was lying on the side of the road in pain. I knew I'd broken my collarbone and I was having difficulty breathing. We were waiting for the ambulance. And I thought to myself, oh, I've got an appointment with my business coach at 10 o'clock this morning. And this was maybe 7 o'clock in the morning. I thought, I'm going to have to send her a message saying I probably won't be able to make it. You know? And of course, I ended up in hospital for several days.
Wow.
And she tells that story a lot in her workshops whenever I'm there. And she said the first thing that came to my mind in that whole situation was, oh, I have to send her a message to say I won't be able to make the meeting.
In the moment things aren't so funny, but like you look back and say, yeah, what was I thinking? Right, that was just how the brain works. But it's a tribute to your. To your being responsible and accountable and considerate of other people. So,
yeah. All right. Well, talk to us a little bit about the mental model part, because that's another thing that I was really attracted to from your work immediately. I mean, you've mentioned Maslow's hierarchy of needs. You've mentioned I can't remember what the other one was you mentioned, but there's a lot of frameworks that you present in the book, and I think there's, you know, great value to those as a visual tool as well.
Yeah, one of my models, I mean, there's so many, it's like there's a lot of like a SWOT analysis, right? If you put they say that consultants, we could not make a living without 4 box matrices, right? We always have to put everything into a 4 box matrix, but there's a reason for that, right? There's a model I learned years ago called Ansoff's, ANSOFF, Ansoff's model. If you have markets and products and services, right? So you could have a new product in a new market. You have a new product in an old market. You have an old product in a new market for an old product. You know what I'm saying, right? You just put them in a 4x4, and it opens up the world of possibilities. So again, the purpose of putting things in a box is so you could see them more clearly, because it gives you a framework. And the framework just—it's almost like here's a great analogy that I've never used before. You want to hear a new original?
Oh, original!
Analogy?
Great, I love it. I always love the originals.
Yeah. So again, this is hot off, never used before. But picture a silverware drawer with knives and forks and spoons, right? If you just dump them all into a drawer, I'm sure you could still find, you know, if you needed 4 forks, 4 knives, and 4 spoons, you could find them, right? But how much easier is it when you have the compartments, you know, the silverware drawer that where you put all the forks, all the knives, all. How much quicker and easier is it to see what you have? To like, if you just had a drawer filled with silverware, you wouldn't know how many you had, right? But if you just looked at the set, you could see, hey, all the knives or all the forks are in the dishwasher, right? Because that compartment is now empty. You wouldn't see it if everything was just thrown in. So that's the same thing. That's a great metaphor for life. So we have all these problems and complexities, but it's by putting things into compartments. So I love that idea of compartmentalization. When you put things into compartments or boxes, you could see in a second what you wouldn't see because of the messiness and the complexity. So that's why I'm going to start using that more often right now. I don't know where that came from, but I think that really...
That's an original metaphor. We've been
right here. You were here as it was born.
Great. I love it. Okay. And so frameworks, yeah, they're a great way of visualization. Now, one of the things that I've been doing quite a lot in a framework that I use, and it's called an empathy map, which is something that was developed by Dave Gray from X-Plane. So I can't take credit for that, but that's a framework that I really love and I use it. And I've been doing it with clients and asking them to, instead of answering the questions in the various boxes of the map and writing words down, I've said, draw something that represents your answer to the various questions. And then we dig a little bit deeper and I say, but you know, you can't write anything down, you have to draw. Yeah. Now this challenges quite a lot of people, but the power is quite amazing, because what we do from that drawing then is I ask them to present that, to explain that to then somebody else, because a person who doesn't know the empathy map and the information that's being put on there can't really get much from the drawings, because often, I mean, mine are awful because they're stick figures or not even good stick figures and that sort of thing. But the process then of telling a story around that, saying, you know, this is my ideal client, what he sees in the world, and here's the image that he sees in the world, and explaining that from my drawing, and we record that. That is so powerful. I found that really powerful. So do you kind of do exercises like that with your frameworks?
Yeah. So one of the things I try to help people do is overcome ICD syndrome, which is I can't draw, right? So if you ask a group of children, 5-year-olds, 6-year-olds, how many of you can draw? How many raise their hand? All of them, right? 100%.
Yeah.
But you ask a group of business professionals, how many of you could draw? And you're lucky if you get a few. So have we lost our ability or our confidence over those 20 or 30 or 40 years? I would say it's our confidence, right? Because we expect, like you just said, oh, they're just stick figure. There's nothing wrong with a stick figure. It's about it's about your effectiveness in getting your idea across. It's not how great an artist you are. So if you could do graphic recordings and you're an amazing artist and someone who could draw, that's great. Then you get extra bonus points. But at the very least, if you could play Pictionary, if you could play charades, then you could communicate through non-visuals, right? You could communicate through hand gestures and movement, and you could also sketch something out. And here's a real-life example. One of my clients, there were some salespeople who were more effective than others. But, you know, people go on a sales call, and you don't know what goes on behind the scenes when they're meeting with a client. So one of the things that we did in the workshop, I put up flip charts, and we had about 15 people. Each person had to draw, no words, just they could use some words and numbers, but mainly draw an image that's kind of sketches out their presentation and any metaphors and analogies they use or stories. Just get it up there. Do a brain dump, right? Get it out of your head and onto the paper. And then they had to present back to the rest of the group as if we were the client. And it was amazing what happened. That session was just transformative, because in the process of doing that, the CEO found that people were using analogies that were wrong, metaphors that were not relevant, and were actually counterproductive. They were telling stories that didn't really illustrate what they did, or they were emphasizing the wrong things. That did not come out until we did this, right? So if someone says they're like a big whale and we're like a little guppy, and the CEO says, not at all, we're not, you know, they may be the whale, but we're maybe another kind of whale, or we're a dolphin, right? But we're not a guppy. Why did you say we were a guppy? So they turn into a whole debate about, you know, were you a piranha, were you a guppy, were you a goldfish, right? You know, I had to bring it back to the, you know, they were going so far off the mark with the metaphor, the fish metaphors. But that resulted in conversations that had them completely revamp how they presented to their clients. And they came up with a number of, people were allowed to come up with their own stories as long as they were consistent in the messaging, right? And in terms of the metaphors they used, they came up with 3 or 4 metaphors that everyone agreed to, and at different times they could pull them out of their bag of tricks. But until we did that exercise, I mean, it dramatically improved sales, it improved customer service, communication, it removed a lot of stress, because people were going out on sales calls and they weren't really sure if they were even saying the right thing. So that's one real life example of how using drawing helped people to see what other people were saying and then fix problems and clarify their messaging.
Yeah, I love that. And it really comes back to having a bit of an having a good understanding of who the ideal clients are and what do we do? What's our vision for us as a business and for them? What do we do for them? And how do we tell that story or give that message to them? So it's sort of storytelling comes into that, and you know, painting the pictures and using the metaphors is really powerful in that whole thing, from the internal exercise you've described to then taking that out to the communication with the customer.
Yeah, I always say everyone has 2 thought bubbles hanging over their heads at all time, whether it's one person like you and me talking here today or our listeners when they listen to this. They're thinking, why should I care and what's in it for me, right? People want to know, why is this interesting and how will this benefit me, right? So if you're not thinking about that, then your messaging is all over the place. You really need to think about, you know, if people are bored or disengaged or checked out, It's usually because they either don't care or they don't see the benefit, right? So if you're talking, if I'm doing a webinar, if you listen to a podcast, if someone starts checking their email and doing other things, it's because you've lost them, not because it's their fault, it's your fault. They're disengaged because you're not giving them a reason to care or to see the benefit. So any metaphor, an example, or story you tell needs to hit both of those targets. Why should they care, and how will they benefit from this story, this example, this product, this service, this innovation? I keep meeting people who say, I just came up with this new app, and they were so excited about it, but they can't explain why I should care about it, right? And here's the classic story. Steve Jobs, when he announced the iPod, instead of saying this little device holds 5 gigabytes of data, which would have been like, all right, who cares, unless you're a techie, he said this little device holds what? 1,000 songs in your pocket. So that's what makes people go, wow, say I could fit my entire CD collection on that little thing and take it with me wherever I go. That's amazing. No one says 5 gigs. Wow, that's unbelievable. I don't know what a gig is. I don't know, you know. So it's like, but if I could carry my CDs with me, my Elvis Costello, my Clash, and my Ramones with me wherever I go, that's pretty unbelievable. So you need to be speaking the language of your audience, using metaphors, analogies, and stories that people will go, wow, that's so cool. Not, I don't have no idea what you're talking about. And I have a lot of app developers. I meet with a lot of people who they're so excited about what they created, but yet they can't sell the benefit. They can't tell people why they should care about who need, you know, I don't know how I would use this or what, how is this better than something else I'm currently using? And they're so excited about the features, but they're not communicating the benefits. I think that's one of the best ways I know to frame that.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, you know, the classic marketing wisdom is around, you know, tell people about the benefits, sell them on the benefits, not the features. And, you know, the two, I like the two thought bubbles, because the classic marketing theory does talk a lot about what's in it for your potential clients and why should they care about it. But explaining, using the whole metaphor and storytelling techniques in that takes this to a whole new level, I think. It really elevates this beyond that theory and into something practical that actually connects people. And since we're all about human marketing, the connection is really important to me in that context. So telling stories and using metaphors and painting pictures, you know, the idea of describing something in a way that your listener actually paints a picture in their mind, and that picture is pretty much what you had intended.
Yeah. One of the classic metaphors, and this is not mine, but this is one of my favorites, is the saying, no one needs a drill. What they need is a hole, right? Mm. So you buy the drill, which is the tool that will give you the hole where you can hammer a nail in or hang a picture, right? So you need is, in fact, you don't even need the hole.
Right? You need a picture on the wall.
So if you keep asking the question, well, why do you need that? Well, why do you need that? Ultimately, like my wife is, you know, she's been trying to get me to hang up a few pictures in the house for like weeks now. At some point, I need to do it. But it's like, to hang the picture, you need a hook. To hang the hook, you need a nail. To hang, you know, hammer the nail, you need a hammer and a nail, right? So the reason you need the hammer and the nail is so my wife will say, thank you for hanging that picture on the wall, right? So we lose somewhere along that track, we lose sight. So that's why I love that. That's why it's one of the classic metaphors of, you know, no one needs, you know, no one needs a drill. Just that one saying has so much power when you're thinking about why people might need your product or service. What's it going to do for them?
That's right. And you know, you look at the drill, take the drill as an example. You look at the information. If you go online, which we're doing a lot more these days to purchase things, if you go online, search for drill bits, and then find, so okay, you're going to have in mind it needs to be this sort of size and it needs to be able to drill a hole in this material. So for me, it might be plasterboard. So they're kind of technical criteria that I'd start with. But after that, you know, it might talk about this has been hardened in, it's tungsten steel, it's been hardened in this sort of flame and it's been treated with this sort of coating. And well,
like really impressive. I have no idea what you're talking about, but it sounds really impressive. Right?
Yeah. And I'm not really sure I care. Why should I care? Yeah. I just want to hang my picture on the wall, right?
Exactly. So sometimes people make things so complex that you actually scare people off, right? So it's like, that's the challenge is, it was Da Vinci who said that simplicity is the ultimate sophistication, If you could simplify complexity without losing the nuance, without dumbing it down, without stripping it of its essence, if you could simplify things so that people can understand, there's an art and magic to doing that. And the best marketers are really good at that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Steve Jobs, you mentioned earlier, yeah. I mean, he was just brilliant at that. Yeah. You look at the Apple logo and their design and, you know, all their products are just, you know, you look at them and you say, well, they're fancy, but they're fancy in a simple way.
Yes. Yeah. That's the beauty of it. I mean, that's a perfect example of the beauty of simplicity, right? Some people have so much bells and whistles and, you know, strip it down. Less is more in those situations in a lot of cases. It's like there's a great TED talk called The Paradox of Choice. When we give people too many choices, they get paralyzed by indecision and they don't make any choice at all. So they say, like, if you go into a wine store, there's an expensive one, there's a middle price one, and there's a cheap one. 90% of people will buy the middle price one, right? This one's too much. This one sounds really cheap. It could be just as delicious, right? But the perception is there. So marketers can actually steer you towards a purchase decision just by how you place things. Like if there were 5 choices or 20 choices, that would also kind of, you know, if you had 20 choices, someone might walk in and walk out. That's happened to me with a few products where I walked into, like, you know, an Apple store, for example. If there are too many options, I get overwhelmed and I don't get any, but give me 3 options. And because again, I'm not a techie, someone else might like 20 options, but you need to know your customer. That's a great example of, like, knowing what your customers want and need and what will help them make a decision.
Yeah, that's right. I suffer from that with podcasts, for example. I keep subscribing to new podcasts I discover, and then when I have the time or make the time to listen to podcasts, and I look at my list of subscribed podcasts and I think, oh gosh, which one should I look at? And I sort of realize that because I've built up this big library of subscriptions, that I'm making it harder and harder for myself to actually focus and make a quick decision on, okay, I'm going to listen to this one now.
Yeah. Like my focus is, you know, my specialty is doing management leadership training and executive coaching. So I used to have a menu of almost every possible type of management leadership training. And I realized I was confusing my customers, that, like, it was getting too difficult. So, like, if one of my clients, the head of HR, calls me and says, just want to know, how much is leadership training? My response is, like, how much is a vacation? You know, how much is a car, right? It's like, I need a little more. Can you give me a little more to go on, right? But once we ask the who, what, when, where, and why questions, we could determine the how, right? Who is it for? What do you want to train people in? When and where are you thinking of doing this? And why are you doing this? And then together, let's come up with the how, right? But if you give me too few choices, I feel like there's nothing to choose from. You give someone too many and they get overwhelmed by the complexity and, you know, by the overwhelmed feeling of indecision. So that's part of the art and science, is to figure out how many choices and how to frame those choices in such a way that you can kind of help guide a customer in the right direction that's best for them, not necessarily best for you, but, you know, what's best for them.
Yeah. And of course, frameworks and visual thinking is a really good way to go about that, right? To simplify things.
Definitely. Because you want them to be able to visualize it. You want them to be able to see what it's like. It's like, would you buy a product on Amazon if there were no pictures? If you Googled something and there was nothing but descriptions, not a single image, how overwhelming and confusing would that be? Whether it's clothing, a tool, you know, whatever, even a book, right? That's the power of visuals to capture your attention. And also, one thing I didn't mention yet is, like, why visuals, without getting into all the brain science. Very simply, 3 words: attention, comprehension, and retention. When you use visual language or visual imagery, it gets people to focus, so it captures your attention. Comprehension increases understanding because you look at it and say, okay, now I get it. And retention is, now that I've seen it, I will remember it, right? So if you just think about why visuals, that sums it up in a nutshell, which, by the way, is a metaphor.
Yeah, great. It's a good point to move on to the buzz. But before saying that, I'll just reinforce what you've just said there, because, you know, going back to my story near the beginning about the canola fields, I mean, there's so much information attached to an image like that. There's, you know, there's a memory, there's a time, there's everything that happened in that time, there's the feelings that were around. Everything is attached to an image, and it's really Good. I know my, I'll mention my business coach again, give a shout out to Joanne. She is very strong in terms of using pictures and images to build presentations. She says, don't make any notes, don't write bullet points, don't script it out. I mean, script it out to rehearse it, but then ditch the script and just come up with some pictures and then rehearse it with the pictures, because those pictures will trigger the whole talk. You could have, you know, two or three pictures and they will trigger a half day workshop even.
Exactly. When people use imagery and tell the story accompanied by the imagery, it's so much more authentic and natural and impactful than, you know, that whole death by bullet point PowerPoint thing. It's just, you know, and people are still doing it. People, you know, it becomes a crutch. It becomes your script. It's your teleprompter, right? But what happens is, while you're talking, what are people in the audience doing? They're reading over your shoulder, right? So if you really want to capture people's attention, get rid of the text. And like you said, have an image. You know, look, Steve Jobs, just go on YouTube and watch his presentations. And he's, you know, one of the greats. He was one of the greats at doing that, communicating visually and through storytelling and metaphor with very little text, if any, on most of his slides.
All right. Well, thanks, Todd. I think it's a good point now to move on to the Buzz, which is our innovation round. And it's designed to help our audience, who are primarily innovators and leaders in their field, with some tips from your experience. So I have five questions, and hopefully you'll inspire the listener to go and do something awesome today as a result.
Okay, great.
So what do you think the number one thing is anyone needs to do to be more innovative?
Well, the cliche is think outside the box. So I'm going to challenge people to tell them to think inside the box. Create your own. You know, there's so many models out there that you could use, but create your own. Just sketch out a four-box matrix, sketch a circle, a pyramid. Just don't try to force things into a model, but if you do a brain dump onto paper and find some way, almost like putting a puzzle together, right? You have all these pieces. Once you, there's this tremendous satisfaction to be able to see the finished puzzle. Similarly, if you could get information out of your head and put it into some kind of framework so you could see it more clearly, you'll start to see new solutions that you maybe hadn't thought of before.
Love it. Yeah. And we've done that with our transformational marketing program. We've developed a blueprint, which essentially is a model. I mean, there's an image and a logo to go with it that is a model of the whole process.
Great.
Okay. What's the best thing you've done to develop new ideas?
Well, I'm a people can't see my bookshelf, but I'm a fanatical reader. So I read again. My background, as I mentioned, is in Shakespeare and poetry and English literature. But I also am a TV addict. So I grew up watching Superman and Batman. So ideas can come from anywhere. So many people think, you know, sitting down and staring at a screen or a blank piece of paper or a blank flip chart is the worst way to come up with ideas. To me, the best way is to not think about it, to do other things. Have that idea percolating, but, you know, Google things, watch TV, read magazines. There's a great quote by the Greek philosopher Heraclitus, where he says, a wonderful harmony arises when we join together the seemingly unconnected. So if you could take the idea that you're working on, the problem you're trying to solve, but find things from other places. Here's a real life example of that. I was once teaching an innovation workshop, and I had everyone get up, and we walked down the block to go to a Barnes & Noble bookstore. Unfortunately, there aren't that many of those left anymore. But we went to the magazine section. I asked everyone to buy a magazine that they wouldn't ordinarily read. So there was this big construction guy, and he bought Bride magazine. And this woman who worked in fashion bought Guns and Ammo. She was very anti-guns, but she bought... Everyone came up with like 20 new ideas from those magazines that they ordinarily wouldn't have looked at or read, because it just... hate to use the pun, triggered another part of your brain and led to other ideas, out of the box, quote unquote, ideas that they wouldn't have thought of otherwise. So you never know where ideas could come from. But I say the worst way to come up with ideas is to go back to the usual place. Go look elsewhere, look outside, listen to music, read poetry, sit in a field of flowers, right? You never know where those ideas are going to come from. So that's what I said. The worst place to come to innovate is at your desk in most situations.
Yeah, I love that. No, I love the quote. I wasn't familiar with that quote, but I'm a big fan of, you know, looking outside your own field and looking to join the dots back to what it is you do. So
yes.
All right. Now, do you have a favorite resource you use most often?
I do, and I don't want to get too personal, but I get 90% of my ideas in the shower. And I should get a commission from this company because I mention them so often. But I use these waterproof notepads called Aquanotes. It's waterproof paper, little memo pads. I can't wait till they come out with flip chart size. I'll never come out of the shower. But I always get ideas when I'm in there taking a shower. And sometimes my wife is knocking on the door like, are you ever coming out of there? And I'm like, I'm working in here. So some of us get ideas while we're walking the dog or on the treadmill or, you know, whatever. And I do get them in different places, driving. In the shower is where I come up with them. And that's why these Aquanotes notepads, it's so great to be able to, with that special pencil and those waterproof pads, just to capture the... How often do you get an idea in the shower and then by the time you get out, you completely forgot it, right?
Yeah.
Doesn't happen anymore when you use these. I should do a commercial for them. They should definitely be paying me.
I love it. Yeah, I love it. My challenge is I often, when I'm writing on my own, which I'm doing a lot more of these days than pre-COVID because of the isolation and so on. So I'm often writing alone now. And in those situations when I'm not talking to somebody else, when there's not the chit chat and the concentration on somebody else's wheel in front of you going on, I find that I come up with a lot of ideas because the mind's kind of wandering all over the shop.
Yeah.
And my challenge then is, you know, getting back, it might be an hour or a 2 hour ride. And, mm-hmm. and I might've had five or six ideas. Yeah. By the time I get back, I now, what were those ideas again?
Yeah. Well, my recommendation there is every phone has that voice memo thing.
Yeah,
So if you're on a bike, you know, if you're out and about, just speak it into the voice memo and you'll capture it. And then you transcribe it when you get home. Cause that's happened to me numerous times where I didn't have something to write on or I couldn't write. Again, the key is getting it out of your head and onto something.
So you can
you can get it back later on.
Yeah, yeah. I guess, it's a case of not wanting to stop.
Yes,
trying to break a record or something like that.
Yeah. So, always, everything's a trade-off, right? You can't do everything. And no more accidents for you.
All right. Now, what's the best way to keep a client on track?
Well, this is where the visual leadership component comes in. It's about having a vision. You know that saying, keep your eyes on the prize, right? It's very easy to, you know, you hit a brick wall metaphor, or you fall back, or you go off track. These are all different metaphors, again. But if you always keep your eyes on the prize, and what's the vision? And if what you're doing is not leading you, moving you forward towards that vision, then you need to say, all right, what's going to get me back on? It's okay to go off track once in a while, because sometimes you discover things that you didn't think about before. But it's also easy to be distracted and to lose sight, and then you miss deadlines or you go in the wrong direction. So to me, the best way to stay on track is to have some kind of visible or tangible representation of what the goal is. In fact, when I was working on my book, I made a little mini mock-up of the book jacket, and I kept it sitting right on my computer. So I saw it every single day. So I said, is this going to take me away from my goal of hitting my book deadline? So just by having that little mini book jacket cover in front of me, that reminded me, keeping your eyes on the prize, that's what my prize was. And that reminded me, because it's very easy to spend 2 or 3 or 10 hours doing something. It's like, I just wasted that. It wasn't wasted necessarily, but it's not getting me towards my goal.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you have something visible or tangible and you visualize what will it look like when you get to your end goal, the trophy, the celebrations, the accolades, or just that feeling of satisfaction, that's what helps you stay on track and helps you from going off on all kinds of tangents. Because otherwise you just never achieve what you're trying to do. So often the big thing that we're trying to do, the thing that has the greatest payoff, that gets put on the back burner because we're always putting out fires and not necessarily focusing on what really matters.
Mm, yeah, I love that. I love the idea of very visual thinking, the idea of having the mock-up book cover in front of you all the time. And I think that's a real powerful one to have. A picture of something that represents the goal, always visible. And it's kind of a reminder, and it triggers the emotion attached to the why I'm doing this as well.
Yeah. It also helps to visualize past successes, remember what that felt like, and say, that felt really good. I want to replicate that again, right?
Mm.
Like when a team wins a championship, like the Super Bowl or the World Series, the first thing they say after, like, I just want to relax and celebrate this one, but they're like, this felt so amazing. I want to do this again. Like they can't wait to get to spring training and start the next season. And we want to have that feeling again. So I love, like, just like with your experience with the canola flowers, it's like, you know what that's like. You want to replicate that, right? It may be in a different context or, I think that's the thing, using our senses to visualize the past and kind of visualize what the future might bring and take steps in that way to make that vision a reality.
Hmm. Yeah, that's great. All right. And finally, what's the number one thing anyone can do to differentiate themselves?
I don't know if you, do you know Bill Nye, the science guy? Do you know him? Is he well known down there? Or is he just American?
I know of him. Yeah, I know of him. He presents on TV, does he?
Yeah. He has his own show and everything. He's a scientist.
I've probably seen him on TV. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, one of his quotes that I love, it's so simple. He said that everyone you will ever meet knows something you don't, and that includes you. So that's the thing. Your story is unique. So some people who say, oh, no one wants to hear my story, or I have nothing to teach anyone. You are the only one in the world who has lived your life, who has your stories, and everything that happened to you can be turned into a story that will teach someone else a lesson. And Eleanor Roosevelt said that learn from the mistakes of others. Life's too short to make them all ourselves. That's why we read these books, success stories and failure stories. By sharing your story, you will help someone else. Stories could be a success story or it could be a cautionary tale. Don't let this happen to you, right? So I think it's one of the greatest, I always use the words G&G, genuine and be genuine and be generous. Be genuine and authentic. Don't make up stories. I was talking to someone yesterday. This guy won this storytelling contest, and then they found out he had made the whole thing up. He admitted it.
Oh, okay.
So all of a sudden, what did that do to his credibility, his authenticity? Great, you told a great story, but it wasn't true, right? So be true, be honest, be credible, be authentic, and also be generous. Share your wisdom, share your knowledge. You may say, oh, what do I know? But any time you share your experience with someone else, you are helping someone else to either help them stay on track, fulfill a dream, keep from making a mistake. So, that feeling of generosity and do things and share your story, not for any reason other than that you might help someone else through sharing that story.
Hmm. Yeah, I love that. So much to love about that sort of being being giving without any expectation of something in return, and also valuing what you have and being authentic to that.
Yeah. One other thought I wanted to share. The on the cover of my book is a rainbow colored eye, a color that no one has in the real world, right? So that means the rainbow represents diversity and inclusion in all its forms. It also represents innovation and creativity. One of the concepts I've been talking about recently is flipping the eye. So often we talk about leadership, it's about your vision. It's about what you want to do. Flipping the eye has two meanings. One is looking internally at yourself, your own belief systems, why you believe, who you are, and how you are as a leader. But it also has to do with flipping the eye. Can we look at the world through the lens of other people who are different from us? With empathy and with compassion, it's not about us as leaders, it's about other people. And my personal mission is making the world a better place, one leader at a time. And to me, everyone is a leader in one way or another. So if you start with that foundation, flipping the eye is about it's not about me anymore. It's about how can I help you make your vision a reality? And that to me is what true leadership is all about.
Hmm. I love that. And that's probably answered my question about the parting advice. Unless you're really keen to give any more, we won't.
I think I'm going to just drop the mic and walk off the stage.
Yeah. Wonderful. All right. Well, thanks, Todd. This has been absolutely fabulous. So where can people find out more about you and also get a hold of your book and maybe even reach out and say thanks for what you've shared with us today?
Sure. My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Jürgen. It was great. So one is LinkedIn with me. I live on LinkedIn. So connect with me on LinkedIn, like and share my posts, and I'm happy to connect with you and interact. So LinkedIn is number one. Number two is my brand new website just launched 2 weeks ago, and it's my name, Todd Churches, Churches, toddchurches.com. And if you go to toddchurches.com/subscribe, you can download my list of my top 52 book recommendations to help you be a more visual leader. So that's my free giveaway if you go to my website. So those are the two main ways. And you can also see my TED Talk on my website, as well as information about my book. And then my book's available wherever books are sold on Amazon or anywhere else. So feel free to reach out to me anytime.
Great. And we'll post all those links in the show notes as well, so people can just click straight through. So finally then, Todd, who else should I get on this podcast and have a conversation with, and why?
God, there's so many people out there that I'm friends with, especially that I've met since the pandemic. But one person who just jumped into my head as you were asking is my friend Rob Salafia, Salafia. He wrote a book called Leading from Your Best Self. And I met him at a leadership conference, and he introduced me to his agent, and his agent is the one who got me my book deal. So I would say pay it forward, pay it back. So Rob Salafia is the person I would recommend. He has a really interesting story. He's a management leadership coach, but he started out as a street performer, a mime, a juggler, and a tap dancer. He actually trained with Gregory Hines and other. So he basically, and he's a Shakespeare person too, like me. So he basically took the arts and everything I just described and applies it to the world of management leadership and executive coaching. So he's a great storyteller, and I would highly recommend you talking to him.
Great. Well, we'll get an introduction to Rob from you and reach out to him to have him on the show. It sounds like it could be a fun conversation.
Yeah, you'll definitely enjoy talking to him.
Hmm. All right. Well, thanks so much for sharing your time and your insights with us so generously today. Todd, I've really enjoyed this. I always love speaking to you. We'll be staying in touch because we've built that relationship. Yeah. And it's always good to have somebody on that I've known from a past interaction and also to keep building that relationship. So thanks for sharing your time today. I'm sure there's lots of value that the listener will get out of this. And all the best.
Thank you, Jürgen. This was a pleasure. And don't, be careful on that bicycle. I don't want that. Just stick with the flowers. With the flowers.
I hope you enjoyed that engaging conversation with Todd, full of visual references, metaphors, stories, and humor, and took something away from his episode. Todd's use of a meta framework for a model of communication that includes physical imagery, mental models, metaphors, and stories really resonated with me, and it's indeed the foundation of his book, Visual Leadership. I'd love to know what you took away from Todd's episode. Leave a comment below the blog post, which you can find at innovabiz.co/Todd Churches. That is TODDCHERCHES. All lowercase, all one word, innovabiz.co/Todd Churches. You'll also find contact information for getting in touch with Todd there, as well as links to his website, his list of 52 book recommendations, also his own book, Visual Leadership, and the other resources we spoke about in today's conversation. Todd suggested that we have a conversation with Rob Salafia, MIT Master Executive Coach and author of Leading From Your Best Self, on a future InnovaBuzz podcast episode. So, Rob, keep an eye on your inbox for an invitation from us to the InnovaBuzz podcast, courtesy of Todd Churches. Tune in again to the next episodes of the InnovaBuzz podcast, where we've got yet more fantastic guests lined up, including Dr. Rick Kirschner, co-author of Dealing With People You Can't Stand, and Jason Case of Points Peak Marketing. Thanks for listening to this episode. Make sure you subscribe to the show to be reminded of new episodes. It's free to subscribe. Leave a review if you like. Even if you don't like me, I'm okay with that. I'm asking you to leave a review because it helps other people find this show. Go to innovabiz.co to join our marketing transformation community and access a free gift my team and I made for you. It's the Marketing Master Mini Class. We want to give you everything you need to transform your marketing into a human-centered, relationship-focused growth engine. Until next time, I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz. Remember, be awesome and keep innovating.